The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire by Edward Gibbon, continued. Cassette 8, Side 2. The ponderous volumes of the Codes and Pandects would furnish ample materials for a minute inquiry into the system of provincial government, as in the space of 6 centuries it was improved by the wisdom of the Roman statesmen and lawyers. It may be sufficient for the historian to select 2 singular and salutary provisions intended to restrain the abuse of authority. 1. For the preservation of peace and order, the governors of the provinces were armed with the sword of justice. They inflicted corporal punishments, and they exercised in capital offences the power of life and death. But they were not authorized to indulge the condemned criminal with the choice of his own execution, or to pronounce a sentence of the mildest and most honourable kind of exile. These prerogatives were reserved to the prefects, who alone could impose the heavy fine of 50 pounds of gold. Their vice-regents were confined to the trifling weight of a few ounces. This distinction, which seems to grant the larger, while it denies the smaller, degree of authority, was founded on a very rational motive. The smaller degree was infinitely more liable to abuse. The passions of a provincial magistrate might frequently provoke him into acts of oppression, which affected only the freedom or the fortunes of the subject. Though, from a principle of prudence, or perhaps of humanity, he might still be terrified by the guilt of innocent blood. It may likewise be considered that exile, considerable fines, or the choice of an easy death relate more particularly to the rich and the noble, and the persons the most exposed to the avarice or resentment of a provincial magistrate were thus removed from his obscure persecution to the more august and impartial tribunal of the Praetorian Prefect. 2. As it was reasonably apprehended that the integrity of the judge might be biased if his interest was concerned or his affections were engaged, the strictest regulations were established to exclude any person, without the special dispensation of the emperor, from the government of the province where he was born, and to prohibit the governor or his son from contracting marriage with a native or an inhabitant, or from purchasing slaves, lands, or houses within the extent of his jurisdiction. Notwithstanding these rigorous precautions, the Emperor Constantine, after a reign of 25 years, still deplores the venal and oppressive administration of justice, and expresses the warmest indignation that the audience of the judge, his dispatch of business, his seasonable delays, and his final sentence were publicly sold either by himself or by the officers of his court. The continuance, and perhaps the impunity, of these crimes is attested by the repetition of impotent laws and ineffectual menaces. All the civil magistrates were drawn from the profession of the law. The celebrated institutes of Justinian are addressed to the youth of his dominions, who had devoted themselves to the study of Roman jurisprudence. And the sovereign condescends to animate their diligence by the assurance that their skill and ability would in time be rewarded by an adequate share in the government of the Republic. The rudiments of this lucrative science were taught in all the considerable cities of the East and West, but the most famous school was that of Berytus, on the coast of Phoenicia, which flourished above 3 centuries from the time of Alexander Severus, the author, perhaps, of an institution so advantageous to his native country. After a regular course of education, which lasted 5 years, the students dispersed themselves through the provinces in search of fortune and honours. Nor could they want an inexhaustible supply of business, in a great empire already corrupted by the multiplicity of laws, of arts, and of vices. The court of the Praetorian Prefect of the East could alone furnish employment for 150 advocates, 64 of whom were distinguished by peculiar privileges, and 2 were annually chosen with a salary of 60 pounds of gold to defend the causes of the treasury. The first experiment was made of their judicial talents, by appointing them to act occasionally as assessors to the magistrates. From thence they were often raised to preside in the tribunals before which they had pleaded. They obtained the government of a province, and by the aid of merit, of reputation, or of favour, they ascended by successive steps to the illustrious dignities of the state. In the practice of the bar, these men had considered reason as the instrument of dispute. They interpreted the laws according to the dictates of private interest, and the same pernicious habits might still adhere to their characters in the public administration of the state. The honour of a liberal profession has indeed been vindicated by ancient and modern advocates, who have filled the most important stations with pure integrity and consummate wisdom. But in the decline of Roman jurisprudence, the ordinary promotion of lawyers was pregnant with mischief and disgrace. The noble art, which had once been preserved as the sacred inheritance of the patricians, was fallen into the hands of freedmen and plebeians, who, with cunning rather than with skill, exercised a sordid and pernicious trade. Some of them procured admittance into families for the purpose of fomenting differences, of encouraging suits, and of preparing a harvest of gain for themselves or their brethren. Others, recluse in their chambers, maintained the gravity of legal professors by furnishing a rich client with subtleties to confound the plainest truth, and with arguments to colour the most unjustifiable pretensions. The splendid and popular class was composed of the advocates who filled the forum with the sound of their turgid and loquacious rhetoric. Careless of fame and of justice, they are described for the most part as ignorant and rapacious guides, who conducted their clients through a maze of expense, of delay, and of disappointment, from whence, after a tedious series of years, they were at length dismissed, when their patience and fortune were almost exhausted. 3. The Masters General of Cavalry and Infantry. In the system of policy introduced by Augustus, the governors, those at least of the imperial provinces, were invested with the full powers of the sovereign himself. Ministers of peace and war, the distribution of rewards and punishments, depended on them alone, and they successively appeared on their tribunal in the robes of civil magistracy, and in complete armour at the head of the Roman legions. The influence of the revenue, the authority of law, and the command of a military force concurred to render their power supreme and absolute. And whenever they were tempted to violate their allegiance, the loyal province which they involved in their rebellion was scarcely sensible of any change in its political state. From the time of Commodus to the reign of Constantine, near 100 governors might be enumerated who, with various success, erected the standard of revolt, and though the innocent were too often sacrificed, the guilty might be sometimes prevented by the suspicious cruelty of their master. To secure his throne and the public tranquillity from these formidable servants, Constantine resolved to divide the military from the civil administration, and to establish, as a permanent and professional distinction, a practice which had been adopted only as an occasional expedient. The supreme jurisdiction exercised by the Praetorian prefects over the armies of the empire was transferred to the two masters general whom he instituted, the one for the cavalry, the other for the infantry. And though each of these illustrious officers was more peculiarly responsible for the discipline of those troops which were under his immediate inspection, they both indifferently commanded in the field the several bodies, whether of horse or foot, which were united in the same army. Their number was soon doubled by the division of the east and west. And as separate generals of the same rank and title were appointed on the four important frontiers of the Rhine, of the upper and the lower Danube, and of the Euphrates, the defence of the Roman Empire was at length committed to 8 masters general of the cavalry and infantry. Under their orders, 35 military commanders were stationed in the provinces, 3 in Britain, 6 in Gaul, 1 in Spain, 1 in Italy, 5 on the upper and 4 on the lower Danube, in Asia 8, 3 in Egypt, and 4 in Africa. The titles of counts and dukes, by which they were properly distinguished, have obtained in modern languages so very different a sense that the use of them may occasion some surprise. But it should be recollected that the second of those appellations is only a corruption of the Latin word which was indiscriminately applied to any military chief. All these provincial generals were therefore dukes, but no more than 10 among them were dignified with the rank of counts or companions, a title of honour or rather of favour, which had been recently invented in the court of Constantine. A gold belt was the ensign which distinguished the office of the counts and dukes, and besides their pay they received a liberal allowance sufficient to maintain 190 servants and 158 horses. They were strictly prohibited from interfering in any matter which related to the administration of justice or the revenue, but the command which they exercised over the troops of their department was independent of the authority of the magistrates. About the same time that Constantine gave a legal sanction to the ecclesiastical order, he instituted in the Roman Empire the nice balance of the civil and the military powers, the emulation and sometimes the discord which reigned between two professions of opposite interests and incompatible manners, was productive of beneficial and of pernicious consequences. It was seldom to be expected that the general and the civil governor of a province should either conspire for the disturbance or should unite for the service of their country. While the one delayed to offer the assistance which the other disdained to solicit, the troops very frequently remained without orders or without supplies. The public safety was betrayed, and the defenseless subjects were left exposed to the fury of the barbarians. The divided administration which had been formed by Constantine relaxed the vigor of the state, while it secured the tranquillity of the monarch. The memory of Constantine has been deservedly censured for another innovation, which corrupted military discipline and prepared the ruin of the empire. The 19 years which preceded his final victory over Licinius had been a period of license and intestine war. The rivals who contended for the possession of the Roman world had withdrawn the greatest part of their forces from the guard of the general frontier, and the principal cities which formed the boundary of their respective dominions were filled with soldiers who considered their countrymen as the most implacable enemies. After the use of these internal garrisons had ceased with the civil war, the conqueror wanted either wisdom or firmness to revive the severe discipline of Diocletian and to suppress a fatal indulgence which habit had endeared and almost confirmed to the military order. From the reign of Constantine, a popular and even legal distinction was admitted between the Palatines and the Borderers, the troops of the court, as they were improperly styled, and the troops of the frontier. The former, elevated by the superiority of their pay and privileges, were permitted, except in the extraordinary emergencies of war, to occupy their tranquil stations in the heart of the provinces. The most flourishing cities were oppressed by the intolerable weight of quarters. The soldiers insensibly forgot the virtues of their profession and contracted only the vices of civil life. They were either degraded by the industry of mechanic trades or enervated by the luxury of baths and theatres. They soon became careless of their martial exercises, curious in their diet and apparel, and while they inspired terror to the subjects of the empire, they trembled at the hostile approach of the barbarians. Ammianus observes that they loved downy beds and houses of marble, and that their cups were heavier than their swords. The chain of fortifications which Diocletian and his colleagues had extended along the banks of the great rivers was no longer maintained with the same care, or defended with the same vigilance. The numbers which still remained under the name of the troops of the frontier might be sufficient for the ordinary defence, but their spirit was degraded by the humiliating reflection that they, who were exposed to the hardships and dangers of a perpetual warfare, were rewarded only with about 2/3 of the pay and emoluments which were lavished on the troops of the court. Even the bands or legions that were raised the nearest to the level of those unworthy favourites were in some measure disgraced by the title of honour which they were allowed to assume. It was in vain that Constantine repeated the most dreadful menaces of fire and sword against the borderers, who should dare to desert their colours, to connive at the inroads of the barbarians, or to participate in the spoil. The mischiefs which flow from injudicious counsels are seldom removed by the application of partial severities, and those succeeding princes laboured to restore the strength and numbers of the frontier garrisons. The empire, till the last moment of its dissolution, continued to languish under the mortal wound which had been so rashly or so weakly inflicted by the hand of Constantine. The same timid policy of dividing whatever is united, of reducing whatever is eminent, of dreading every active power, and of expecting that the most feeble will prove the most obedient, seems to pervade the institutions of several princes, and particularly those of Constantine. The martial pride of the legions, whose victorious camps had so often been the scene of rebellion, was nourished by the memory of their past exploits and the consciousness of their actual strength. As long as they maintained their ancient establishment of 6,000 men, they subsisted, under the reign of Diocletian, each of them singly a visible and important object in the military history of the Roman Empire. A few years afterwards, these gigantic bodies were shrunk to a very diminutive size, and when 7 legions, with some auxiliaries, defended the city of Amida against the Persians, the total garrison, with the inhabitants of both sexes and the peasants of the deserted country, did not exceed the number of 20,000 persons. From this fact, and from similar examples, there is reason to believe that the constitution of the legionary troops, to which they partly owed their valour and discipline, was dissolved by Constantine, and that the bands of Roman infantry, which still assumed the same names and the same honours, consisted only of 1,000 or 1,500 men. The conspiracy of so many separate detachments, each of which was awed by the sense of its own weakness, could easily be checked, and the successors of Constantine might indulge their love of ostentation by issuing their orders to 132 legions inscribed on the muster roll of their numerous armies. The remainder of their troops was distributed into several hundred cohorts of infantry and squadrons of cavalry. Their arms, titles, and ensigns were calculated to inspire terror, and to display the variety of nations who marched under the imperial standard. And not a vestige was left of that severe simplicity which, in the ages of freedom and victory, had distinguished the line of battle of a Roman army from the confused host of an Asiatic monarch. A more particular enumeration, drawn from the Notitia, might exercise the diligence of an antiquary. But the historian will content himself with observing that the number of permanent stations or garrisons established on the frontiers of the empire amounted to 583, and that under the successors of Constantine, the complete force of the military establishment was computed at 645,000 soldiers. An effort so prodigious surpassed the wants of a more ancient and the faculties of a later period. In the various states of society, armies are recruited from very different motives. Barbarians are urged by their love of war. The citizens of a free republic may be prompted by a principle of duty. The subjects, or at least the nobles, of a monarchy are animated by a sentiment of honour. But the timid and luxurious inhabitants of a declining empire must be allured into the service by the hopes of profit, or compelled by the dread of punishment. The resources of the Roman treasury were exhausted by the increase of pay, by the repetition of donatives, and by the invention of new emoluments and indulgences, which, in the opinion of the provincial youth, might compensate the hardships and dangers of a military life. Yet, although the stature was lowered, although slaves, at least by a tacit connivance, were indiscriminately received into the ranks, the insurmountable difficulty of procuring a regular and adequate supply of volunteers obliged the emperors to adopt more effectual and coercive methods. The lands bestowed on the veterans as the free reward of their valour were henceforward granted under a condition which contains the first rudiment of the feudal tenures, that their sons, who succeeded to the inheritance, should devote themselves to the profession of arms as soon as they attained the age of manhood. And their cowardly refusal was punished by the loss of honour, of fortune, or even of life. But as the annual growth of the sons of the veterans bore a very small proportion to the demands of the service, levies of men were frequently required from the provinces, and every proprietor was obliged either to take up arms, or to procure a substitute, or to purchase his exemption by the payment of a heavy fine. The sum of 42 pieces of gold, to which it was reduced, ascertains the exorbitant price of volunteers and the reluctance with which the government admitted of this alternative. Such was the horror for the profession of a soldier which had affected the minds of the degenerate Romans, that many of the youth of Italy and the provinces chose to cut off the fingers of their right hand to escape from being pressed into the service. And this strange expedient was so commonly practiced as to deserve the severe animadversion of the laws, and a peculiar name in the Latin language. They were called murci. The person and property of a Roman knight who had mutilated his 2 sons were sold at public auction by order of Augustus. The introduction of barbarians into the Roman armies became every day more universal, more necessary, and more fatal. the most daring of the Scythians, of the Goths, and of the Germans, who delighted in war, and who found it more profitable to defend than to ravage the provinces, were enrolled not only in the auxiliaries of their respective nations, but in the legions themselves, and among the most distinguished of the Palatine troops. As they freely mingled with the subjects of the empire, they gradually learned to despise their manners and to imitate their arts. They abjured the implicit reverence which the pride of Rome had exacted from their ignorance, while they acquired the knowledge and possession of those advantages by which alone she supported her declining greatness. The barbarian soldiers who displayed any military talents were advanced, without exception, to the most important commands, and the names of the tribunes, of the counts and dukes, and of the generals themselves betray a foreign origin, which they no longer condescended to disguise. They were often entrusted with the conduct of a war against their countrymen. And though most of them preferred the ties of allegiance to those of blood, they did not always avoid the guilt, or at least the suspicion, of holding a treasonable correspondence with the enemy, of inviting his invasion, or of sparing his retreat. The camps and the palace of the son of Constantine were governed by the powerful faction of the Franks, who preserved the strictest connection with each other and with their country, and who resented every personal affront as a national indignity. When the tyrant Caligula was suspected of an intention to invest a very extraordinary candidate with the consular robes, the sacrilegious profanation would have scarcely excited less astonishment if, instead of a horse, the noblest chieftain of Germany or Britain had been the object of his choice. The revolution of 3 centuries had produced so remarkable a change in the prejudices of the people that, with the public approbation, Constantine showed his successors the example of bestowing the honours of the consulship on the barbarians, who, by their merit and services, had deserved to be ranked among the first of the Romans. But as these hardy veterans, who had been educated in the ignorance or contempt of the laws, were incapable of exercising any civil offices, the powers of the human mind were contracted by the irreconcilable separation of talents as well as of professions. The accomplished citizens of the Greek and Roman republics, whose characters could adapt themselves to the bar, the senate, the camp, or the schools, had learned to write, to speak, and to act with the same spirit and with equal abilities. 4. The ministers of the palace. Besides the magistrates and generals, who at a distance from the court diffused their delegated authority over the provinces and armies, the emperor conferred the rank of illustrious on 7 of his more immediate servants, to whose fidelity he entrusted his safety, or his counsels, or his treasures. 1. The private apartments of the palace were governed by a favourite eunuch who, in the language of that age, was styled the praepositus, or the prefect of the sacred bedchamber. His duty was to attend the emperor in his hours of state, or in those of amusement, and to perform about his person all those menial services which can only derive their splendour from the influence of royalty. Under a prince who deserved to reign, the great chamberlain, for such we may call him, was an useful and humble domestic. But an artful domestic, who improves every occasion of unguarded confidence, will insensibly acquire over a feeble mind that ascendant which harsh wisdom and uncomplying virtue can seldom obtain. The degenerate grandsons of Theodosius, who were invisible to their subjects and contemptible to their enemies, exalted the prefects of their bedchamber above the heads of all the ministers of the palace. And even his deputy, the first of the splendid train of slaves who waited in the presence, was thought worthy to rank before the respectable proconsuls of Greece or Asia. The jurisdiction of the chamberlain was acknowledged by the counts, or superintendents, who regulated the 2 important provinces of the magnificence of the wardrobe and of the luxury of the imperial table. 2. The principal administration of public affairs was committed to the diligence and abilities of the master of the offices. He was the supreme magistrate of the palace, inspected the discipline of the civil and military schools, and received appeals from all parts of the empire in the causes which related to that numerous army of privileged persons who, as the servants of the court, had obtained for themselves and families a right to decline the authority of the ordinary judges, The correspondence between the prince and his subjects was managed by the four scrinia, or offices of this minister of state. The first was appropriated to memorials, the second to epistles, the third to petitions, and the fourth to papers and orders of a miscellaneous kind. Each of these was directed by an inferior master of respectable dignity, and the whole business was dispatched by 148 secretaries chosen for the most part from the profession of the law, on account of the variety of abstracts of reports and references which frequently occurred in the exercise of their several functions. From a condescension which in former ages would have been esteemed unworthy of the Roman majesty, a particular secretary was allowed for the Greek language, and interpreters were appointed to receive the ambassadors of the barbarians. But the Department of Foreign Affairs, which constitutes so essential a part of modern policy, seldom diverted the attention of the master of the offices. His mind was more seriously engaged by the general direction of the posts and arsenals of the empire. There were 34 cities, 15 in the east and 19 in the west, in which regular companies of workmen were perpetually employed in fabricating defensive armor, offensive weapons of all sorts, and military engines, which were deposited in the arsenals and occasionally delivered for the service of the troops. 3. In the course of 9 centuries, the officer of quaestor had experienced a very singular revolution. In the infancy of Rome, 2 inferior magistrates were annually elected by the people to relieve the consuls from the invidious management of the public treasure. A similar assistant was granted to every proconsul and to every praetor who exercised a military or provincial command. With the extent of conquest, the 2 quaestors were gradually multiplied to the number of 4, of 8, of 20, and for a short time perhaps of 40. And the noblest citizens ambitiously solicited an office which gave them a seat in the Senate, and a just hope of obtaining the honours of the Republic. Whilst Augustus affected to maintain the freedom of election, he consented to accept the annual privilege of recommending, or rather indeed of nominating, a certain proportion of candidates, and it was his custom to select one of these distinguished youths to read his orations or epistles in the assemblies of the Senate. The practice of Augustus was imitated by succeeding princes. The occasional commission was established as a permanent office, and the favoured quaestor, assuming a new and more illustrious character, alone survived the suppression of his ancient and useless colleagues. As the orations which he composed in the name of the emperor acquired the force, and at length the form, of absolute edicts, he was considered as the representative of the legislative power, the oracle of the council, and the original source of the civil jurisprudence. He was sometimes invited to take his seat in the supreme judicature of the imperial consistory, with the praetorian prefects and the master of the offices. And he was frequently requested to resolve the doubts of inferior judges. But as he was not oppressed with a variety of subordinate business, his leisure and talents were employed to cultivate that dignified style of eloquence which, in the corruption of taste and language, still preserves the majesty of the Roman laws. In some respects, the office of the imperial quaestor may be compared with that of a modern chancellor. But the use of a great seal, which seems to have been adopted by the illiterate barbarians, was never introduced to attest the public acts of the emperors. 4. The extraordinary title of Count of the Sacred Largesses was bestowed on the treasurer-general of the revenue, with the intention perhaps of inculcating that every payment flowed from the voluntary bounty of the monarch. To conceive the almost infinite detail of the annual and daily expense of the civil and military administration in every part of a great empire would exceed the powers of the most vigorous imagination. The actual account employed several hundred persons, distributed into 11 different offices, which were artfully contrived to examine and control their respective operations. The multitude of these agents had a natural tendency to increase, and it was more than once thought expedient to dismiss to their native homes the useless supernumeraries who, deserting their honest labours, had pressed with too much eagerness into the lucrative profession of the finances. 29 provincial receivers, of whom 18 were honoured with the title of Count, corresponded with the treasurer, and he extended his jurisdiction over the mines from whence the precious metals were extracted, over the mints in which they were converted into the current coin, and over the public treasuries of the most important cities, where they were deposited for the service of the state. The foreign trade of the emperor was regulated by this minister, who directed likewise all the linen and woolen manufactures, in which the successive operations of spinning, weaving, and dyeing were executed, chiefly by women of a servile condition, for the use of the palace and army. 26 of these institutions are enumerated in the West, where the arts had been more recently introduced, and a still larger proportion may be allowed for the industrious provinces of the East. 5. Besides the public revenue, which an absolute monarch might levy and expend according to his pleasure, the emperors, in the capacity of opulent citizens, possessed a very extensive property which was administered by the count, or treasurer, of the private estate. Some part had perhaps been the ancient demesnes of kings and republics. Some accessions might be derived from the families which were successfully invested with the purple. But the most considerable portion flowed from the impure source of confiscations and forfeitures. The imperial estates were scattered through the provinces from Mauritania to Britain, but the rich and fertile soil of Cappadocia tempted the monarch to acquire in that country his fairest possessions, and either Constantine or his successors embraced the occasion of justifying avarice by religious zeal. They suppressed the rich temple of Comana, where the high priest of the goddess of war supported the dignity of a sovereign prince, and they applied to their private use the consecrated lands, which were inhabited by 6,000 subjects or slaves of the deity and her ministers. But these were not the valuable inhabitants. The plains that stretch from the foot of Mount Argaeus to the banks of the Sarus bred a generous race of horses, renowned above all others in the ancient world for their majestic shape and incomparable swiftness. These sacred animals, destined for the service of the palace and the imperial games, were protected by the laws from the profanation of a vulgar master. The demesnes of Cappadocia were important enough to require the inspection of a count. Officers of an inferior rank were stationed in the other parts of the empire, and the deputies of the private, as well as those of the public treasurer, were maintained in the exercise of their independent functions and encouraged to control the authority of the provincial magistrates. 6 and 7. The chosen bands of cavalry and infantry which guarded the person of the emperor were under the immediate command of the two counts of the domestics. The whole number consisted of 3,500 men, divided into 7 schools, or troops, of 500 each. And in the East this honourable service was almost entirely appropriated to the Armenians. Whenever on public ceremonies they were drawn up in the courts and porticos of the palace, their lofty stature, silent order, and splendid arms of silver and gold displayed a martial pomp not unworthy of the Roman majesty. From the 7 schools, 2 companies of horse and foot were selected, of the protectors, whose advantageous station was the hope and reward of the most deserving soldiers. They mounted guard in the interior apartments, and were occasionally dispatched into the provinces to execute with celerity and vigour the orders of their master. The counts of the domestics had succeeded to the office of the praetorian prefects. Like the prefect, they aspired from the service of the palace to the command of armies. The perpetual intercourse between the court and the provinces was facilitated by the construction of roads and the institution of posts. But these beneficial establishments were accidentally connected with a pernicious and intolerable abuse. 200 or 300 agents, or messengers, were employed, under the jurisdiction of the master of the offices, to announce the names of the annual consuls and the edicts or victories of the emperors. They insensibly assumed the license of reporting whatever they could observe of the conduct, either of magistrates or of private citizens, and were soon considered as the eyes of the monarch and the scourge of the people. Under the warm influence of a feeble reign, they multiplied to the incredible number of 10,000, disdained the mild though frequent admonitions of the laws, and exercised in the profitable management of the posts a rapacious and insolent oppression. These official spies, who regularly corresponded with the palace, were encouraged by favor and reward anxiously to watch the progress of every treasonable design, from the faint and latent symptoms of disaffection to the actual preparation of an open revolt. Their careless or criminal violation of truth and justice was covered by the consecrated mask of zeal, and they might securely aim their poisoned arrows at the breast either of the guilty or the innocent who had provoked their resentment or refused to purchase their silence. A faithful subject of Syria, perhaps, or of Britain, was exposed to the danger, or at least to the dread, of being dragged in chains to the court of Milan or Constantinople, to defend his life and fortune against the malicious charge of these privileged informers. The ordinary administration was conducted by those methods which extreme necessity can alone palliate, and the defects of evidence were diligently supplied by the use of torture. The deceitful and dangerous experiment of the criminal quaestion, as it is emphatically styled, was admitted rather than approved in the jurisprudence of the Romans. They applied this sanguinary mode of examination only to servile bodies, whose sufferings were seldom weighed by those haughty republicans in the scale of justice or humanity. But they would never consent to violate the sacred person of a citizen till they possessed the clearest evidence of his guilt. The annals of tyranny, from the reign of Tiberius to that of Domitian, circumstantially relate the executions of many innocent victims, but as long as the faintest remembrance was kept alive of the national freedom and honour, the last hours of a Roman were secure from the danger of ignominious torture. The conduct of the provincial magistrates was not, however, regulated by the practice of the city or the strict maxims of the civilians. They found the use of torture established not only among the slaves of Oriental despotism, but among the Macedonians, who obeyed a limited monarch, among the Rhodians, who flourished by the liberty of commerce, and even among the sage Athenians, who had asserted and adorned the dignity of humankind. The acquiescence of the provincials encouraged their governors to acquire, or perhaps to usurp, a discretionary power of employing the rack to extort from vagrants or plebeian criminals the confession of their guilt, till they insensibly proceeded to confound the distinction of rank and to disregard the privileges of Roman citizens. The apprehensions of the subjects urged them to solicit, and the interest of the sovereign engaged him to grant, a variety of special exemptions which tacitly allowed and even authorized the general use of torture. They protected all persons of illustrious or honorable rank, bishops and their presbyters, professors of the liberal arts, soldiers and their families, municipal officers and their posterity to the third generation, and all children under the age of puberty. But a fatal maxim was introduced into the new jurisprudence of the empire, that in the case of treason, which included every offence that the subtlety of lawyers could derive from an hostile intention towards the prince or republic, all privileges were suspended, and all conditions were reduced to the same ignominious level. As the safety of the emperor was avowedly preferred to every consideration of justice or humanity, the dignity of age and the tenderness of youth were alike exposed to the most cruel tortures. And the terrors of a malicious information which might select them as the accomplices, or even as the witnesses, perhaps, of an imaginary crime, perpetually hung over the heads of the principal citizens of the Roman world. These evils, however terrible they may appear, were confined to the smaller number of Roman subjects whose dangerous situation was in some degree compensated by the enjoyment of those advantages, either of nature or of fortune, which exposed them to the jealousy of the monarch. The obscure millions of a great empire have much less to dread from the cruelty than from the avarice of their masters, and their humble happiness is principally affected by the grievance of excessive taxes, which, gently pressing on the wealthy, descend with accelerated weight on the meaner and more indigent classes of society. An ingenious philosopher has calculated the universal measure of the public impositions by the degree of freedom and servitude, and ventures to assert that, according to an invariable law of nature, it must always increase with the former and diminish in a just proportion to the latter. But this reflection, which would tend to alleviate the miseries of despotism, is contradicted, at least by the history of the Roman Empire, which accuses the same princes of despoiling the Senate of its authority and the provinces of their wealth. Without abolishing all the various customs and duties on merchandises, which are imperceptibly discharged by the apparent choice of the purchaser, the policy of Constantine and his successors preferred a simple and direct mode of taxation, more congenial to the spirit of an arbitrary government. The name and use of the indictions, which served to ascertain the chronology of the Middle Ages, was derived from the regular practice of the Roman tributes. The emperor subscribed with his own hand, and in purple ink, the solemn edict or indiction, which was fixed up in the principal city of each diocese during 2 months previous to the first day of September. And by a very easy connection of ideas, the word indiction was transferred to the measure of tribute which it prescribed, and to the annual term which it allowed for the payment. This general estimate of the supplies was proportioned to the real and imaginary wants of the state. But as often as the expense exceeded the revenue, or the revenue fell short of the computation, an additional tax under the name of superindiction was imposed on the people. And the most valuable attribute of sovereignty was communicated to the Praetorian prefects, who on some occasions were permitted to provide for the unforeseen and extraordinary exigencies of the public service. The execution of these laws consisted of two distinct operations. This book is continued on Cassette 9, Side 1.